One of the stories of our time is the huge rise in real estate prices in big cities and other desirable places to live. We began taking it for granted years ago that major urban areas had shockingly high home prices and monthly rents. But they continue to defy gravity by rising and rising and rising and only briefly coming down during the Great Recession. Our guest this hour examines how we got here. Randy Shaw is the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Randy Shaw is the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, which houses homeless single adults in San Francisco. This is a return visit for Randy. He joined us almost 5 years ago to talk about an update to another of his works, The Activist's Handbook. Randy Shaw, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
And there's always plenty to be an activist about, isn't there, Randy?
Well, there is, and particularly the housing crisis, which requires solutions, which is why I wrote this book, because we can't continue the way things are. It's unsustainable.
Now, the story told in this book is all around you all the time, because you do work in the Bay Area, but the ghost ship fire in Oakland plays a part. Tell us about that.
Well, I wrote this book right in the wake of the ghost ship fire, which occurred almost 2 years ago this week on December 2nd, 2016, where in a warehouse which was illegally housing people, did not meet any of the fire codes. They had regular parties, and one night at one of the parties, a fire broke out, and since there was no fire exits, 36 people died, which was a remarkable tragedy. Just think, you go to a concert in Oakland, and suddenly you die. And it said to me that there is something really, really wrong about what has happened with our housing supply, because Oakland was always the affordable alternative to San Francisco. And now artists and bohemians couldn't even afford Oakland. They were living in dangerous housing and led to the deaths of many. And it just said that something is really wrong. And I originally started to write the book about the Bay Area, and then I realized cities like Portland and Seattle and Los Angeles and Austin and Minneapolis, which were not like San Francisco and New York City, had not been extremely expensive, for a long time. Even they were starting to price out young people, and in the working and middle class could no longer afford to live. The teachers, the nurses, they were priced out of the cities they worked in.
So, as you pointed out, not just the Bay Area, though. I mean, Minneapolis, you mentioned a couple of others in there, but generally just around the country, if a city is a good size and has some attraction for people to move to, it's going to have real estate prices getting out of reach.
Well, there was a movie made called Slacker about Austin, about how you could basically be a slacker in Austin and live there. Now, slackers can't afford Austin. And places like Portland and Seattle, we used to always contrast them with San Francisco, that, Seattle and Portland, people are more into lifestyle than maximizing income. Well, now, both those cities are much less affordable than they ever have been in their history.
Randy, you cite decades of misguided land use policies, that's in quotes, as a major contributor. Expand on that.
Well, one thing I learned in doing this book, in Generation Priced Out, is that what almost all the cities have in common, all these progressive cities that publicly promote inclusion and say they want greater diversity, but their land use policies prevent the building of apartments in the majority of their residential land. So we have neighborhoods, in cities like Portland, Seattle, and San Francisco, and all the ones that I discuss in the book, that you think of these cities as kind of have a lot of tenants, but you can only build a mansion. You can't build a duplex or a fourplex in many of these neighborhoods. And when people hear that, they think, wait, that doesn't make sense. But that's what the boomer homeowners have kind of dictated, and they've kind of controlled land use policy in every major urban city for the past 30 years.
So they've wanted to stay to a single-family residential and not multiple family, not multiple unit.
Right, and it's very strange. You see these public hearings where there's enormous hostility to tenants, as if because you don't own, you're going to be a dangerous psychopath or something. And yet in many of the neighborhoods I write about across the country, apartments were allowed until the 1960s. So you have 1930s apartments that have been there forever. Tenants aren't causing any problems, yet the owners come down to these land use hearings and oppose any, they will not let the zoning build you an apartment. So if you can't build apartments in over half your city, it's very difficult to deal with the affordability crisis.
Now, how about the other part of this, though, the supply and demand part? Because what is it that would stop somebody who was thinking of building places and did have the proper zoning approvals to not build apartments that would be affordable? They make less money on them, wouldn't they?
Well, it's very complex with the land use, because if you can't build, in what you find in city after city is most of the development is occurring in the downtown areas where multi-unit buildings are allowed. If you can't build fourplexes and duplexes or anything like that in vast stretches of cities, then the scarce new construction is going to cost more. And people often say, well, gee, they're mostly building luxury housing. That's because all they can build are tall buildings in downtown areas. They're not allowed to build what we call the missing middle housing in other parts of the city. And that's where families with kids are more likely to live. So the policy needs can vary. It could change in all of the cities I write about, a generation priced out. It could change next year by just rezoning to legalize apartments in all residential neighborhoods. And that would really increase the supply because all of the cities I talk about are creating a lot of jobs. I mean, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, you name it. They're creating jobs, but where are the people living who are in those jobs? And the alternative is incredibly long car commutes, which is terrible for the environment. And we need to discourage these long car commutes and have people live closer to their work.
We're about a minute away from a break, but I want to introduce another thread that you follow, which is the lack of strong tenant-renter protections. How big an issue is this you're seeing over the years?
Well, in places like Portland and Seattle and Austin and Minneapolis, the state government bars any rent control or just cause eviction protection. So there's always a vulnerability that when in good times, the tenants can just be told to leave, and that's a problem. It's also a problem when rental housing, which is so hard to get built, can be easily demolished. And many cities don't have demolition controls, which is, you know, you have to protect the existing supply and build more housing. You have to do both. Some people just want to do one or the other, but you have to do both.
Much more to talk about with Randy Shaw. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone and by email. We'll be back to talk about expensive housing with Randy Shaw and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Randy Shaw, a longtime activist. He runs the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco and has for a long time. He has also written several other books, including The Activist Handbook, for which he joined us a couple of years ago for an updated version. His latest book is about how expensive it is to live in urban areas in America. It's called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about the issue and share your own experience as well. You may have one to put into the pile here. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you paint this as a generational divide, Randy. You think boomers made things worse for millennials?
Well, unfortunately, I'm a boomer, and I wish I didn't have to say this, but it's true. I mean, you look at who are at these hearings to prevent any apartments from being built and housing to become more affordable, and it's boomers who, unfortunately, I mean, from a policy perspective, they have an economic self-interest to say, don't let anything be built. I mean, housing prices have gone through the roof for homeowners in all the cities I mentioned because of artificial scarcity. So when they talk about preserving neighborhoods, protecting neighborhood character, by preventing apartments from being built, what they're really saying is restrict supply so my values and property values can escalate. And then when their houses are sold, I mean, there isn't a house in San Francisco that sells for under $1 million. Or even now in Berkeley and all the city, even in places like Portland where it used to be an affordable, I used to be a teacher. I have an old friend who bought a house in the 70s as a teacher. A teacher couldn't afford a house in that neighborhood in Portland today. And when we start pricing out our teachers and nurses, the people who run the PTA meetings, the people who are sort of the fabric of the community, that's not good for cities. And that's why I wrote this book to convince policymakers to change things.
Well, so you bring up, obviously, you have to in this context, talk about gentrification. And people seem to take it as inevitable that will happen, where a rundown neighborhood is going to be attractive to younger artsy types or something, and all of a sudden the rents start going up.
Well, what's interesting about that, you know, I've worked my whole career in the Tenderloin, I have a book called The Tenderloin, Sex, Crime, and Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco, and I describe how the Tenderloin became the only San Francisco neighborhood that'll never be gentrified. So I've been on the front lines of that. And what a lot of people don't understand, they think, well, as long as we don't build these luxury housing projects, as long as we stop development, we won't gentrify. Yet all of the neighborhoods in San Francisco that gentrified, there was no development at all. People just buy the houses when they come on the market, and there's a bidding war because of the scarce supply. So the notion that not building housing is a strategy to stop gentrification is just completely false. And yet you'd be surprised how many people believe that. They talk about, well, new housing is luxury, but as I show in the book, almost all of the units that really sell for a lot in San Francisco were existing housing, not anything that had been built in the last 10 years. So there's a lot of false views about what the causes of gentrification are, and new development is not, it can be under certain circumstances, but that's not what's happened in most cities.
So, if the people who had been living in neighborhoods that gentrified were living there because the rents were low, have you watched the process happen often enough that you can see what the first arrivals, the beachhead established by the higher dollar people is?
Well, I think what happens, and you see this in Portland, you see this in LA, that neighborhoods get gentrified, and then when people are priced out of those neighborhoods, they go to the adjacent neighborhoods. So you see in Portland, neighborhoods that no one ever thought of would be gentrified. And the same thing with L.A. I write in the book about places like, I grew up in L.A., and neighborhoods I had never even heard of, like Highland Park, are now completely gentrified because downtown became gentrified. And so people said, oh, I can't afford to live there. What's the next closest neighborhood? So that's why you have to have a strategy of building affordable housing. And I know Metro Portland just passed a $650 million affordable housing bond in November, which was a very, very great move by the people of your state.
Well, so in most cases, though, if you don't do things like pass $650 million bonds, how do you make it attractive to the people who are doing the building to build things like you're talking about? And like you mentioned missing middle housing, which we've talked about on the program before, things like fourplexes and sixplexes and apartments above businesses that used to form this big middle range of housing that just didn't get added to over the decades.
Well, it's because we downzoned those neighborhoods across the urban America in the 70s to not allow it. In San Francisco, you have vast stretches of the city that the whole west side of San Francisco, you can build a four-story mansion, but you can't build a duplex. So we've prevented that kind of missing middle housing from being built, and that's true in all the neighborhoods and all the cities I describe in the book, and it really doesn't make sense. And those are that's the kind of housing that has been the fabric, as you say, of these neighborhoods, and you can't build anymore. And yet you could build it in the 30s, 40s, 20s, 50s, 60s, but zoning changed, and they suddenly said, no, we don't want that anymore. That doesn't make any sense. And that's why I wrote the book again, because I think if people read the book, they'll say, hey, it's not inevitable that we have to be an expensive city. We can create more opportunities for working people to live in this city.
All right, there's an environmental view that you say is often missing from the housing discussion that you lay out here. What is that?
Well, I think you see, particularly in the Northwest, Seattle and Portland, so many of the activists around infill housing really come from an environmental perspective because they realize that having people being able to ride their bike or take public transit to work is a lot better than having them to drive from the suburbs to where they have to live because they can't afford the cities and get in those long car commutes, which is really afflicting so much of urban America. Greenhouse gas emissions are primarily caused by those cars. And so there's kind of a weird view, in my city of Berkeley, which has become very anti-development, people drive Priuses and they recycle and they may have solar panels, but then they don't have any housing being built. And meanwhile, we have 120,000 people having to commute from Sacramento to the Bay Area. Does that make any sense that we would not do the infill housing and see that as an environmental priority? But generationally, some of the older environmentalists, they want to preserve lakes and mountains and streams, but they don't think in terms of infill housing as a critical aspect of stopping climate change.
And how you keep the community from having to expand outward toward those lakes and mountains and streams.
Right. Now, you're lucky in Oregon and Washington that you have those state conservation districts where they restrict it. They sort of try to force the housing to be infill, but often it still can mean that things don't get built because of the zoning restrictions.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking again to Randy Shaw. He's the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's go to some of the specific examples here. You obviously, Chapter 1 in San Francisco, where you live now, you helped pass laws, apparently, like an ordinance that limited rent hikes in San Francisco. So, A, is it still intact? And B, you're saying without it, the situation would have been much worse?
Well, this is what I say about San Francisco is we've passed every pro-tenant and tenant and rental housing protection measure that the Constitution will allow and the courts will uphold, and yet we still have the worst affordability crisis in the United States. So clearly just passing laws protecting tenants isn't enough. You have to build more housing, which we've really failed to do. I mean, for decades, San Francisco has not built anywhere near number of housing. Seattle builds twice as much housing as we build, and they've done a much better job. But, you know, L.A., the same thing is true. And all of these cities had, you know, L.A. has 1 million more people since 1970, yet they've hardly built any housing. Where are those people going to live if you don't build the housing? Well, it's like a game of musical chairs. The prices will go up because there's so many people circulating around a small number of units. So that's been our big failure. And one of the things I talk in the book is I write about builders and how they're treated in cities. And, you know, their neighborhood groups are allowed to appeal projects forever. The approval process to get something from the time you submit your plans can be years. Our cities claim to want to be inclusive, but our whole system is geared up to keep newcomers out, which is it's a big inconsistency, especially when all these cities are very pro-immigrant rights and they want to have immigrants, but they don't want to house them anywhere. So that's why I wrote this book again, because I really think we need to get our land use policies consistent with our other views about how we want our cities to be inclusive.
Well, as you point out, lots of low-cost units were demolished in San Francisco over the years. What replaced them?
Yes. Well, in San Francisco and in many places, all those demolitions and urban renewal is upscale housing. I mean, the whole South of Market area, if your listeners are familiar with the Museum of Modern Art and all that, those used to be all single-room occupancy hotels. And, you know, the legacy of urban renewal actually spawned what was at once a very progressive neighborhood preservation movement that's saying, stop demolishing our houses for these upscale things. But what ended up happening now is it became neighbors have the right to stop anyone else from living in their neighborhood that they don't want. It's become a very strange process where we have a city problem, which is affordable housing, but we allow economically self-interested homeowners to decide the policy. And that's why I write in the book a lot about the YIMBY movement that's come out and the pro-housing movement, and you have place groups like Portland for Everyone in Portland who have really tried to bring a pro-housing approach. And finally, we have a counterbalance to the boomer homeowners who used to kind of monopolize the field.
Did you say YIMBY as in yes in my backyard?
Yes in my backyard. And the YIMBY movement is really growing in city after city, and you're getting millennials coming out to the hearings in force. And so instead of it just being homeowners saying don't build, you now have millennials, many who identify as YIMBYs, saying do build. We want the building. We need the units. And I think that's the real great hope that we're going to start seeing, and I think we are seeing in city after city. I describe in the book, and there's been some recent developments in Minneapolis as recently as last week, approving triplexes in all neighborhoods. I think progress is being made because this younger generation is saying, look, we're priced out. If we don't do something, we're never going to be able to live in cities anymore.
Randy Shaw, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the head of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco, helping homeless single adults find housing. He has written a number of books, including The Activist's Handbook, which is what he joined us for the last time, about 5 years ago. His latest book is called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And you can join the conversation on the exchange about why it just costs so much to buy and rent real estate in bigger cities in particular, but you know, we're seeing it in our area too. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Stan in Ashland who says, I wonder whether your guest has considered the usefulness of variations of a Georgist land tax, i.e. a tax that prevents the private taking of community-created increases in the price of land. That from Stan in Ashland.
Well, you know, that gets talked about a lot. I think the politics of making that happen become difficult. And, you know, in California and many places, the California's tax policy makes no sense because the boomer homeowners also, we have a Prop 13 which limits their property taxes. Someone who buys, a millennial who buys a house next door can be paying property taxes at three or four times the rate, which on top of the higher price. So everyone is now, Henry George has gotten a second life these days because of the inequities of the property tax system. I just think just political challenges to getting those reforms implemented.
I want to move on from San Francisco to the second chapter in the book about Los Angeles, where you grew up. And you mentioned some of the issues already, that a million more people live there than in 1970 and not many more houses. So what has happened to the places that used to be affordable, like Boyle Heights and Highland Park?
Well, what's really sad about L.A. is that they spent so much time, so many years, not really building any housing or any affordable housing, that, you know, neighborhoods that were once, like places like Highland Park, which no one could have imagined would be gentrified, now it was called by Marketplace of NPR a few years ago, the symbol of urban gentrification. I describe in the book how Boyle Heights, which is next door, which is another place that no one imagined would ever be even thinking in the terms of gentrification, how they're now trying to fight off becoming Highland Park. But it just, what happens is that many people think that if they just stop development from happening, all will be well. But if you don't build affordable housing or build housing that has some affordable units, the people will say, okay, I couldn't live in downtown. I can't live in Culver City. I can't live in these other neighborhoods, Silver Lake, which was long gentrified. I'm going to go next door because that's where the opportunities are. And then, of course, people always see the next door to the gentrified neighborhood as the next hotspot, right? And there's a whole industry that promotes hotspots and gets people to buy. And that's true all over America. So you have to be, you know, I list all these strategies in Generation Priced Out for being proactive, not just saying, okay, we're just going to sit tight and not let anything be built and all will be well, because it won't be well.
Well, you even mentioned in the book that there are campaigns against art galleries, which made me kind of scratch my head, because, I mean, weren't artists once considered among the starving class?
Well, this was a different thing, and they've taken a very aggressive approach. And as I describe also in the Activist Handbook, how sometimes activists like have to, you know, sit. Remember, they used to sit up in trees to stop old growth forests from being cut. Sometimes activists have to take a sort of a by all means necessary approach. But I think the stakes are pretty high, because what are our cities going to be if we just have rich people and poor people living in subsidized housing? I mean, you're going to have incredible inequality, and the middle class, which has been sort of the backbone of our urban America, will over time be gone.
So you mentioned that there was a big vote for a bond issue to build houses for the homeless on the ballot in Los Angeles in the November 2016 election,
mm-hmm.
and that went, it was passed?
Well, you know what you find? People all across America are supporting these housing bonds and homeless funding, but then the challenge, which they really have in L.A. and we're about to have in San Francisco, is, okay, which neighborhood's going to allow the housing to be built? And L.A. has had a humongous problem in that the voters overwhelmingly backed housing for the homeless, just don't put it in my neighborhood. And Mayor Garcetti's have become very personally involved in getting this to happen, because they promised, you know, they have the worst homeless crisis in the United States. They promised, the politicians said, if you vote for this bond, we'll make a difference. And now they can't, it's hard to get implemented. They're finally moving forward on some projects. But people are saying, wait a second, we just voted for that. What happened to the money?
All right, let's get out of California for a bit, because you did mention Austin. That's one of the places you cover in the book, and there's a major difference there in tenant rights. Are there any tenant rights in Texas compared to what California has?
I'll tell you, those listening who rent should be glad they're not renting in Texas, because they don't really believe in tenant rights, and you can't even... I write in the book about a 244-unit apartment building housing low-income families that was just demolished and everyone evicted, because in Texas you can't stop that. And you think, what happened to that site? Well, Oracle's now there. I was there a few weeks ago, the big Oracle factory. And
you mean it went from residential to industrial?
Yeah, well, they built one apartment building for the Oracle employees, and then the rest of the land is an Oracle, 10,000-square-foot Oracle facility. Oracle came in, and in 4 hours, they bought 40,000 acres. So, you know, and where are those tech workers going to live? Or cities don't really think, oh, wait a second now. You're just bringing in all these Oracle workers. Where are they going to live? Well, they're going to go into the existing supply, which inflates the cost and drives out people who can't meet that cost, right? So it's a scenario. We're seeing that now with the Amazon 2 headquarters and the controversy in New York, because people realize that what Amazon with Seattle rising rents is that you can't just create a lot of jobs without any housing, and that's where cities have gone astray and what my book urges them to stop doing.
So tell us, for example, in Austin, what Greg Kassar has attempted to do.
Well, I think he's a real. You have to, one theme of my book is you really need to have someone in elected office in the city who's committed to building housing, and he's really done that, and he's built bridges. He ended up getting Austin passed a $250 million housing bond, which everyone told Kazar that if he did over $100 million, they had no chance of passing it. It passed with 70% of the vote with a $250 million. But he's also tried to increase density and understands you have to provide. If you talk about a city that Austin that claims it wants to promote diversity and inclusion, well, you have to do it by creating housing opportunities. And that's kind of the main theme of my book, which is that cities have, if you want to be diverse and inclusive, you actually have to create the housing that produces that. And if you don't, then it's just rhetoric and it's sort of hypocrisy that a lot of these very blue and progressive cities can be very hypocritical on their land use policies.
Many more examples to talk about with Randy Shaw. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You can join the conversation by phone or email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Randy Shaw and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about real estate prices and rents and how they continue to go up and up and seem to defy gravity over the years, particularly in bigger cities, particularly on the West Coast. Randy Shaw is an activist in San Francisco, runs the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, has written other books, including The Activist's Handbook. He's back with a new one called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You can join this conversation by phone at 800-838-3700. Or share your thoughts by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Chapter 4 has an intriguing title, Can Building Housing Lower Rents? Seattle and Denver Say Yes. Jeff says, really?
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, Seattle home prices, we're at a record high, as were rents, and they both plummeted in the last year. And Denver has seen similar reductions. And so you can make a difference. I mean, Amazon had an unusual circumstance where they had this building boom. I mean, you know, Amazon was advertising 10,000 new jobs a month. And so no matter how fast you build, you can't keep up with that. But then their hiring is totally sort of slowed. So Seattle does know, understand that you have to build. And some people think, wait, that means my rents go down. What it really means is that the rents on vacant units are no longer going up. And often they're going down, even in San Francisco, where we've had an increase in supply. So supply makes a difference. You can't, you know, people say, wait, are you saying we can build our way out of the housing crisis? No, building alone isn't enough, but not building ensures you're not getting out of the crisis. We've seen what not building does, and it's just been a disaster. So you have to do many things I describe in the book, but building housing to keep up with population and jobs growth should be an automatic thing that we do, right? I mean, isn't that kind of common sense?
All right, so building one of them, and what else then? What else has to be part of that mix?
Well, you have to preserve your existing housing, but also you have to be very strategic about, you know, how you build. I mean, I talk about, people say they can't find sites, but there's a lot of public land that I describe in New York City, how there was a former armory, a huge block-long armory in a gentrifying neighborhood, and Mayor Bill de Blasio, who calls himself a progressive, decided that he wanted luxury condos on that public land. And I described the big fight in the book. Why would you put luxury condos in a site that could be affordable housing? I mean, it's you have to be strategic and thoughtful and think of the goal of who do we want to live in our city. And in these urban cities I talk about in the book, but over a dozen, they're losing the middle class. So I think the focus needs to be how do we create more housing opportunities for the middle class? And I lay out the blueprint for doing so, and I think there's increasing support for that. Instead of just saying, we claim we care about the middle class, but we're not going to let any missing middle housing be built, which is where we are today.
All right. So when I think about why somebody like Bill de Blasio, an avowed progressive, would go ahead and go for luxury condos instead of more affordable housing, I always come back to the point of the people who invest, the people who own already, the people who build. There's money, money, money. You can make more tax money on luxury condos.
The campaign contributions by real estate, you know, they're the biggest campaign donors. But you're right in that the industry, I mean, that's that is a problem. I mean, there's a lot of developers, per se, who support everything that I say in my book, who want to be able to build. They want to build business. They want to build. They don't want to just build high-rise upscale housing. They want to build all kinds of housing. So they're really not the opponents of what we're talking about. There's just a sense of thoughtlessness where officials like de Blasio can say, hey, we can get a lot more money for the city if we make it luxury condos than if it's affordable housing, without thinking about, but what about the neighborhood diversity that you say you care about? It shouldn't be all about maximizing profits.
Well, but then how do you adjust that? Then how do you make it worth somebody's while, although perhaps somewhat less worthwhile than for building the luxury condos or high rises?
Well, you see, that I don't think the problem is we developers are eager to build if we make it feasible for them to build by not having a 4-year approval process, by saying they can't build in half of the neighborhoods in the city, right? I mean, the reason builders don't build is that our process makes it so difficult. It's not that there's not enough profit in it if it's done the right way. If you just told builders, hey, we'll turn your plans around in a year and you can build in all these neighborhoods and build apartments and everything, they'd say, great, when can I start? But if we say you only can build in downtown areas and where you have to have a 20-story building to make it pencil, and we're going to keep your project held up for 4 years before you can start construction, they're going to say, I'm going to build somewhere else. I'm going to go to another city. And that's what's happened in our major cities, that the economics don't work for them because we've made it not work for them.
So then how, Randy, do you end up making the process faster without turning it into like super siting authority where, you know, things could be fast-tracked and the people in the neighborhood barely feel like they have time to get their thoughts registered?
Well, I think Seattle is doing a very good job of that because, unlike San Francisco, Seattle doesn't have political appointees at every stage making decisions on what gets approved. Seattle has a zoning law, and if you build a project that's consistent, it's called as of right, you can build. And San Francisco, meanwhile, it has a system where you have to go to an approval process by political appointees, and if the neighbors don't like that result, they can then go to another political process with the elected board of supervisors. And if they don't like that result, and at one point you can spend $617, just write a check. You don't have to live anywhere near the project, and you can ask for discretionary review of any project, even if it's as of right. So cities don't have to give all those options to slow down the process. Seattle is really a model for how you can, and Denver, of how you can effectively get housing built. And that's why there's so much more development going on there.
Let me come back to the issue about rents there, though, because from what you were saying after the initial claim of that rents are going down, is that it sounds like they're more like just stabilizing. They're not actually declining
rising as fast. Yeah, and the rents on vacant units have actually gone down. What landlords are asking for a one bedroom is less today in Seattle than it was 6 months ago. But again, these are marginal differences. And people always say to me, well, are you saying San Francisco is going to be all affordable again? No, because the rents that we're set at because of the supply problem, the home price, the rents are always very high. But if we start building more housing now, 5 years from now, the city will look very differently. It takes a while to see the impact of construction, but Seattle is seeing a plummeting of home prices, which, you know, yes, it's off a level that is higher than Seattle folks ever dreamed that it would reach, but at least we've shown that building additional supply does affect the market.
We've been talking in fairly general terms about a lot of what's going on here. There are lots of good anecdotes in the book, too, and there's one you give in Denver about a business put up a happily gentrifying the neighborhood sign.
Well, some of these folks don't really get it, do they? When you have a thing called happily gentrifying the neighborhood, it's not going to sit very well with an African American population that feels displaced from that neighborhood, and that's what happened there. The same thing when one of the major coffee places that was seen threatening in Boyle Heights in L.A. was opened up on Cesar Chavez Avenue, and the landlord I describe in this eviction attempt, who is evicting all these mariachi players who play in the Mariachi Plaza in Boyle Heights, he wanted to rename their apartment building the Mariachi Apartments. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, you can.
A little tone deaf, huh?
Yeah. I would say you have to be a little smarter. But I think the vast majority of people in the real estate, the building industry, do want to get more housing. It's more the homeowners who don't want it, and that's been the political challenge. And I think that's why I think there's a generational divide. And now that millennials are being priced out, I mean, we have stories in the Bay Area about teachers who are living in cars or who are living in doubled-up apartments, who have hour-long commutes. Well, how can they hang out with the kids and do after-school activities and sponsor clubs if they have an hour commute each way? And that doesn't work, and I'm sure that's the same thing true in Oregon. I think the housing market there is really spiraling.
Well, you know, you've mentioned Oregon a couple of times. It sounds like you're pretty much in tune with what's going on, certainly in Portland. But, you know, the issue that happens to the communities that we serve on both sides of the state line is that you get people moving north from San Francisco and L.A. who've sold houses that are, but they're certainly worth a lot in dollars, and they can buy a house that's a lot more house up here.
That's exactly right. I'm old enough to remember where Tom McCall, former governor of Oregon, didn't want all the Californians to come to the state.
Right.
And, you're going to get more Californians because of our problems with the affordability. And I know people who the person who took the photo from my book now lives in Ashland, Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And they love Ashland. It's just so much more affordable.
Although Ashland third least affordable place in Oregon, I think, behind Lake Oswego and Bend.
I was just going to say that, and Ashland is probably one of the more expensive places in Oregon, but compared to the Bay Area, it's a bargain.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what you get. And the interesting thing about gentrification in the cities themselves, though, the sources of all this back in California, for example, is gentrification, as I see it, really reverses the white flight of the 1950s, doesn't it?
Yes, it has. And there's the racial element of gentrification. I have a chapter in the book about how it's played out in the Mission and New York City and also Oakland, which is a big concern because they're losing their black population. And there's an overlay between the gentrification and the decline in racial diversity, which is why we need to change our land use policies to make sure we create more opportunities for people who aren't rich to live in cities.
So give us some more steps then. I mean, what are some of the things that cities can do to not become monocultures, to not do like what Manhattan does, where you're generally white and generally wealthy? You got to have one or the other to be able to live in
there. Cities can also buy existing buildings and when they're for sale and protect the affordability of the units, which is happening now in more and more cities are picking that up, that it costs a lot of money to build housing, and you have to find sites, and it's a four-year process. Hey, but if you buy this building, you can just immediately make sure it's affordable. You keep all the tenants paying their current rents, and you move tenants in at affordable rates beyond that. So buying existing buildings can be a very, very smart strategy, and it should be one of the many things cities are doing. They shouldn't just think everything has to be new construction or renovation. Buy existing buildings, and you can buy up blocks, if you have to, in certain neighborhoods to protect them from gentrification, if that's the city's goal. So, again, that takes money, but when you pass bonds, money can be used for things like that, and cities need to be a little more creative. Like I say, the public land, all cities have own so many parking lots. All the cities I see their city-owned parking lots. Why aren't we building housing on those parking lots? And it's just because there's just a sense, well, it's a parking lot, but we have to think differently and more creatively, which is why I wrote Generation Priced Out to encourage that.
Air rights over parking lots, that sort of thing. We have, essentially missing middle housing above it.
Well, you could even build, people are talking, you could build all the vacant shopping malls that we have. And, I do post a lot of this stuff on, I'm on Twitter at @BeyondCron, @BeyondCron, and I talk about what we're doing in all these cities, because there is, like, right now, and there's cities, they're looking at vacant shopping malls and saying, hey, this is a great housing opportunity site, right? You got a flat land, the shopping mall is dead, let's build something productive and revitalize the area. So we just have to be a lot more creative and sort of stop being on automatic pilot, given the crisis that we're in.
So there's another factor we need to bring in here, which is not just where people live, but where people work, because that obviously is in transition. So, I mean, are the people looking at the potential future that includes more affordable housing also looking at jobs created and how that might change, A, where people work, and B, how much housing they can afford?
Well, I think what the Amazon headquarters discussion sort of showed is the big employers want to be in cities. They don't want to be in rural America because they don't feel the workforce is there. And so we have more and more jobs being created in cities that I write about in the book, but not the housing. And that's the challenge. It's you know, I quote someone in the book who says in Berkeley, why don't these tech companies just move to Idaho? We wouldn't have this problem. But actually, if tech moved to Idaho, which they're not inclined to do because they don't have a workforce there, the teachers, the nurses, the janitors, the hotel workers, they'd still be in the Bay Area, right? Because that's where their jobs are. And we still have to find a way to house people. There's a lot of jobs that have to be performed in these cities, and those people should have a place to live in these cities. They always have, historically, until the last decade.
Now, Randy, you mentioned about bond issues that allow public housing to be built in some places. You mentioned cities that have bought some buildings to keep the rents from going up. I mean, but for public money involvement, we're not going to get to the point where you're seeing housing projects like we used to see, are we?
No, all the bond money is used for nonprofit housing, or you know, it's not the public housing was. New public housing hasn't come back in America since the 70s, and I don't see much prospect. Some people promote it, but I don't see there's no political support for it. But you can have a lot more subsidized housing. And one of the things I haven't even mentioned is that, you know, most renters in America are entitled to federal housing assistance, which they don't get. 75% of eligible households don't get it. And so the lack of the federal money is a big problem, but my book is really about working people and how they deserve to live in cities and we need to keep them there.
All right, the book is called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. It's the work of Randy Shaw in San Francisco. It'll be at Powell's in Portland on the 4th of December. Randy, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.